You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In recent years, the pundits have pretty much simplified presidential elections into a map of red states and blue states. In other words, where either the Republicans or the Democrats are strongest. Yet presidential campaigns have almost always had notable third-party candidates. And joining me now to look at their impact are Walter Stone, a professor of political science at the University of California, Davis, and Ron Rappaport, the John Marshall Professor of Government at the College of William and Mary. They are the co-authors of Three's a Crowd, The Dynamic of Third Parties, Ross Perot and the Republican Resurgence. Very pleased to welcome them to this month's Backstory. Hello.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
Why has our system always seemed to favor two major parties? Is this something that was envisioned by the Founding Fathers?
No, it really wasn't envisioned, but it has been, I think, built up. A number of institutions have been created that have reinforced the two-party system.
Well, Britain has always had primarily a two-party system. Whenever we talk about places like Italy or Israel, where there's a lot of fluidity, we describe the two-party system as leading to more stable government, don't we?
Well, I think it's the fundamental institutions that tend to reinforce the two-party system, especially the winner-take-all system, as opposed to a proportional representation system.
Right. And I think in some countries, the lack of cohesion often also yields to the proportional representation system. So that in Italy, when they tried to move to first past the post, you know, it did not really end their instability of government and of politics.
But in this country and in England, aren't two of the major parties former third parties? The Labour Party was a third party. The Republican Party began as a third party, didn't it?
That's right. And it's not impossible to imagine that a third party would supplant one of the two major parties. But the odds are against it.
In general, when a third party like the Republicans comes into existence, it comes into existence around an issue like slavery. And that was an issue that neither of the major parties, the Democrats or the Whigs, were able to respond to because they both had very strong Southern contingents. And so the Republicans were able to grab onto an issue, and neither party was able to respond to that. For instance, with Ross Perot in 92, he grabbed onto an issue, but the Republican Party was able to respond in areas like economic nationalism, the budget, and reform. And in 1994, they were able to successfully co-opt a lot of the Perot movement. That was not possible in the 1850s and the early 1860s. When slavery was an issue that neither party was really able to co-opt on.
And that co-optation that Ron is referring to is a common pattern after the emergence of a relatively successful third party.
So third parties emerge because a two-party system can't always provide a clear choice for the voters. And we talked about the Republicans emerging because of the issue of slavery, but then we saw it in the other direction with the Dixiecrats, didn't we?
Well, I mean, the Dixiecrats were a very regional party. They were a party that actually only got about 3% of the vote. And so as a result, they really had much less of an impact on the major parties. I think if a third party achieves a large vote, as Perot did, as the populists did in the 1890s, as George Wallace did in 1968, then the major parties have much more of an incentive to try to co-opt. So I think, you know, our work really deals primarily with major third-party efforts where the parties get enough votes to really grab the attention and to say to the major parties, look, here's a group you aren't serving, no one is serving. If you want to expand your coalition, you might want to go after these people.
Of course, that's not the purpose of the third party. The third party is trying to win votes in its own right. But it does, as Ron says, send a very clear signal to the major parties that there's a constituency there that is available.
Well, they're trying to win votes, but in many circumstances, many instances, I'm assuming that they're trying to make a point even more because it's unlikely that they are going to win many electoral votes. Even Ross Perot, who made one of the strongest third-party runs, I think, in the history of the United States. He didn't win any electoral votes, did he?
He didn't win any electoral votes, but remember, he was actually ahead in the polls as late as May and June before the national convention. So it's not quite right, I think, to say that he didn't think there was any chance that he would win.
Do we know if voters usually think of supporting a third-party candidate as a form of protest, or do they actually imagine that these candidates can win?
Well, certainly, I think there are different types of third parties. That when you're looking at the Prohibition Party, when you're looking at the Libertarian Party, Vegetarian Party. I mean, I think these parties are there primarily to make a statement. I think when you were looking at Ross Perot's party, and if Michael Bloomberg were to get into the race, I think they would do so with the idea that they think they have a real chance of winning. And as Walt said, Perot led for about 6 weeks. I mean, if you look at the range of the campaign, Perot led for more of it than did George Bush, who was the incumbent president. So I think that you need to really distinguish these parties and their elites and their voters differ in their motivations. But I think what we found in our work is that the better you thought Perot was going to do, the more likely you were to support him. And so people who really thought he was going to do abysmally were much more likely to go to the major party that they felt closer to. So I think the fact Perot was, getting a large part of the vote helped him get more votes.
A recent study that has implications for politics suggests that people generally tend to choose the thing that's least extreme, even if one of the others appeals to them more, what's more convenient and least and less extreme. In the case of Ross Perot, was he perceived as extreme at all?
Well, he was, I think, perceived as a centrist candidate. And in our analysis for our study, we show that that's partially true, in that he was a relatively centrist on some of the issues that tend to divide the major parties, on the left-right scale. But on other issues, such as the ones Ron mentioned earlier, he was certainly more committed, if not more extreme. I mean, he did distinguish himself pretty clearly on issues of reform and the budget and economic nationalism.
Now, you said that in his case, his message was co-opted. We've seen other co-opting in other ways. For example, Eugene V. Debs, the highest vote he ever got was 6% in 1912. But much of his platform was later adopted as part of the New Deal. So perhaps Ross Perot was a success in a way because he was trying to pressure the Republican Party to take on certain platform ideas, and they did.
I think that's right, and I think where you really see that is the contract with America. The contract with America was crafted in part by Frank Luntz, who's a Republican pollster and actually done polling for Perot.
We know, because he was a guest on the show so long ago.
And he went to Gingrich and to the Republicans and said, if you guys are going to win soon, you need to co-opt this constituency. And the contract with America, which people think of as, a very conservative Republican document, in fact was much more a Perot document. It was heavily oriented to reform. It did not mention abortion. It did not mention free trade. And so it had some economic nationalism in it. It had balanced the budget. It had reform. And this was a very successful appeal to Perot supporters. And they tried to target Perot supporters in 94 with this message and were very successful at doing it. And ultimately, Perot actually endorsed the Republicans. And the Perot vote shifted 2-1 to the Republicans in 1994 over how they had voted in 1992 for Congress.
And that's a big part of our point, is that I think a lot of people dismiss, especially Perot, because he was seen as, something of a crackpot. He had a lot of money, spent a lot of money on the campaign. And so a number of people, lots of observers, including scholars, thought that he really was kind of a flash-in-the-pan candidate who to be sure, captured a large vote, but did not really have a lasting impact. And our the point of our book is to show that he really did have a long-term impact as and fit a mold that other third parties have also stepped into.
We're talking about third parties on Backstory today. My guests are Ron Rappaport, the John Marshall Professor of Government at the College of William & Mary, and Walter Stone, a professor of political science at the University of California at Davis, co-authors of Three's a Crowd, The Dynamics of Third Parties, Ross Perot and the Republican Resurgence. Well, I imagine that a major problem for most third-party candidates is money, but that wasn't Ross Perot's problem, was it?
No, it really wasn't. But I think it is, you know, as Walt said, Perot did have a lot of money, and I think it made political scientists think that he did well because of his money. But what we find in our book is that Perot had really spent very little money at the time he took the lead against Clinton and Bush. In fact, he had spent less than a third of what either of them had spent, and had spent about the same amount as Paul Tsongas and Pat Buchanan, who were minor candidates in 1992. What Perot did was he used the ballot access problem to his advantage by mobilizing lots and lots of people. Perot was a genius at getting on free talk shows. Larry King, of course, was where he announced, but he was on a whole lot of others. And these, when he was on these, many people would call in. And this was how he organized his campaign. In fact, the campaign had a lot of disorganization in it because you had multiple people in the same state wanting to run the campaign. And in the state of Illinois, for instance, they had different lists of electors. Right, so they, you know, there was a lot of confusion because of this, but money became important in the general election campaign. But at the point where Perot was running his best, he had really spent very little money compared even to minor candidates for the nomination.
And don't third-party candidates, at least the ones who come to public attention, generally enter the race rather late? After the major parties have already pretty much established who they're going to run, so they don't have to spend as much money, but also seem to be the man on the white horse coming to save us from this terrible alternative that we have?
Yeah, it's easier for a third party, I think, candidate to run against a particular candidate, because once the major parties nominate candidates, then their warts start to come out, and it's no longer an abstraction, and so they can identify those weaknesses and discontent that the electorate may have with the particular nominees. The other reason I think you see that pattern is because sometimes third-party candidates come out of they're a defeated major party candidate. So, and we may see that this time, where we've got a large number of people who are running for one of the two major party nominations. The races are likely to be sewn up relatively early with all the front-loading, and then you're going to have, you know, some discontent perhaps with one or both of the candidates that the two major parties are settling on, and some pressure from other quarters for maybe a losing candidate to step in and run, say, on Unity 08. So.
Because both parties are kind of polarized. In the Republicans, if a centrist takes the nomination, then somebody on the right, like Sam Brownback, might very well be tempted. For the Democrats, if somebody like Hillary Clinton is nominated, then a Dennis Kucinich or someone further to the left might very well be tempted?
Sure. I mean, there is, you know, anytime you choose a candidate, there are going to be constituencies within the parties and within the larger electorate that are dissatisfied with that particular candidate. As you say, there is a certain amount of polarization in the electorate, and that may create some room for a third-party candidate to make that kind of appeal.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about this more. I'm reminded of a call I got, a very angry call I got after the election between George Bush and Al Gore. A listener called in very angry and said, "We have to eliminate all third-party candidates." And we'll find out just what kind of impact third-party candidates actually have as we continue this conversation with Walter Stone, professor of political science at the University of California, Davis, and Ron Rappaport, the John Marshall Professor of Government at the College of William & Mary, co-authors of Three's a Crowd, The Dynamic of Third Parties, Ross Perot, and the Republican Resurgence. Stay with us. We're back with Walter Stone and Ron Rappaport talking about third parties on today's Backstory. Are third parties likely to be more successful on a local level? For example, during my lifetime, there have been any number of members of Congress from other parties. Vito Marcantonio here from New York. Now there's Bernie Sanders in the Senate. Are they unique instances?
Well, they clearly are not. I think it's, in terms of building a national party, I think it's very hard to build it from the bottom up. It may be that with the internet, this, you know, these costs have become much smaller, and you have an organization this year, Unity 08, which is creating a party which is entirely online. But I think at the local level, you've had this because you've had leaders who can build parties out of existing groups, often environmental groups, anti-war groups, and the like. So I think at the local level, you often can sort of build these. They tend to be parties that don't have a whole lot of staying power. They tend to revolve around, you know, a particular issue, a particular individual. I think at the national level, though, it has proven very, very difficult to start as a grassroots party and to build up. There's a party called the New Party that has been trying to do this for quite a while with very limited success. So I think that you can do it around specific people, but in terms of building a party, as we think of it, that is broader across the country, I think it's very, very difficult to do. I think you tend to need a candidate and an issue embodied by that candidate to make the appeal to draw the individuals in.
The incredible diversity of offices and of just geographical and social diversity across the country means that a local constituency may exist in a particular state or a locality that would be receptive to a third party. But as Ron says, the cost of mobilizing across that diversity and all the offices that are involved and so on is just extraordinary. And the Democratic and Republican parties have such a long-standing tradition that people identify with. They understand where they are, where they stand. They are channels of ambition, so that people that want to seek offices otherwise try to influence the process through the electoral process to gravitate to one of the parties.
We're less likely to see a Robert La Follette or someone like that these days because the two large parties have become so powerfully entrenched?
Well, I think Bob La Follette is still a possibility. I think Ron would agree with that in the sense that, just as he said, I mean, if you have an attractive candidate who can represent a constituency, a set of issues that people are concerned about at the national level. But even Bob La Follette was not able to, I mean, he had more staying power on the local level in the upper Midwest than he did nationally. It's just very difficult to sustain a national movement.
As Theodore Roosevelt discovered when he ran in 1912 as the Progressive Party candidate, he split the Republican vote, and some credit him with giving Woodrow Wilson the presidency. Is that true, do you think? Is it always problematic to determine who voted which way?
Well, it's the problem is we're not an experimental science. We can't run the election several times with and without particular candidates, with and without a third-party candidate.
So, and you can't poll the people as they come out of the polling places on Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, you can ask people what their preferences are, and you can try to reconstruct what they would have done in the absence of a third-party candidate. And you mentioned before the break Ralph Nader. And certainly people did that, and there are careful studies that try to do that. But you just can't rerun the campaign, and so you don't know how people will react who end up supporting a candidate like Nader or Roosevelt in 1912, how they would react to the campaign in the absence of that candidate.
Well, the Ralph Nader defenders say that people who voted for him would not have voted for Al Gore. And if anything, he may very well have drawn some votes to George Bush in reaction to him.
Yeah, in the end, we have to make personal judgments about the evidence and what is compelling and convincing. And I guess my view, I'm not sure where Ron stands on this, but my view is that given that the election was so close in Florida and Nader attracted as many votes as he did, And the polling showed pretty clearly what people's preference order was. I think that had Nader not been running, Gore would have won Florida.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think one thing that people forget is that Pat Buchanan, who was, of course, one of the reasons for the butterfly ballot, got on the ballot at the very last minute in 2000. It was a court decision that put him back on the ballot. So, you know, there were more third parties than just Nader. And as Walt says, in an election as exquisitely close as 2000, and especially in Florida, you know, anything could have shifted that result as to the outcome. But I think had Nader not been on the ballot, from what we know, I completely agree that that Gore would have carried Florida.
Even though Pat Buchanan was probably taking some votes away from George Bush.
Right, right. But if you take them both off the ballot, you may not even have the butterfly ballot, which was problematic. And, of course, Nader polled much more strongly than did Buchanan in 2000.
Let's go back to Teddy Roosevelt. He did very well in that election, but did he run because he really wanted, he thought he could win, or was he just trying to punish William Howard Taft for the direction he was taking the country?
Well, of course, he ran ahead of Taft in the election and very easily could have won that election.
So he was probably the most successful of the third-party candidates in this
aside
country's history?
Aside from the Republicans, right, which you mentioned earlier. I mean, the Republican Party, you know, ran in 1856 and then ran in 1860 and won.
Yeah, but did Fremont do as well as Teddy Roosevelt?
No. In the first time out, he did not. But again, the advantage the Republicans had was that neither Democrat nor Republican could really co-opt that issue. The Republicans, when they nominated Charles Evans Hughes, who was pretty much a progressive, even though he had not, I believe, supported Roosevelt, they were sort of moving to a little bit towards the Roosevelt position. So in a sense, there was this sort of co-optation that was possible. This was clearly a strain within the Republican Party, the progressive movement.
Well, and Wilson picked up the progressive program as well. I think.
And absolutely, yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Both, yeah. I think both in that case, both parties tried to respond. I mean, the progressive movement was a very strong social movement and political movement that both parties tried to respond to.
I'm talking with Ron Rappaport and Walter Stone, co-authors of Three is a Crowd, The Dynamic of Third Parties. In today's backstory look at third parties, this is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Eugene V. Debs, I mentioned him earlier. His most successful run as the Socialist Party candidate was also in 1912, the same year that Teddy Roosevelt ran on the Progressive Party, and he got 6% of the vote, but he never was a factor later. It's interesting that he did best in a third-party year. I guess he was the fourth party.
Yeah.
And the socialists, people have tried to understand why socialism has never taken root in U.S. politics, and there are lots of theories about why that's the case, about our history and the absence of a kind of feudal structure in our history, and so on, so that and a strong class structure to our politics. But it's certainly the case that that he wasn't able to convert that into a longstanding movement.
What? Right. How did third party candidacies affect Harry Truman's election versus Thomas Dewey?
Well, again, you had two third parties, both of which were fairly marginal. One on the left, with Henry Wallace, one on the right. Together, they attracted around, I think, 6% of the vote. So it was not a very large percentage of the vote. And as the election turned out, it really did not affect the outcome of the election. I think there was a feeling it could have more of an effect in the South, that it could take more states away from Truman, but it did not. It took a few, but it was not very many electoral votes. And then I think Wallace's effect was spread out much more evenly through the country, so he got no electoral votes, and I think had very, very little effect. But I think what it shows is when there are issues that the parties are not able to capture, that then the third party can, you know, basically form around those issues. And if those issues are ones that have a whole lot of support, third parties do better than if they have little support. And if the major party candidates are unpopular, the third parties do better than if the major parties are popular. There's both a push and a pull, right? Your point about sort of the lateness of third-party entry has a lot to do with once the candidates are nominated, there is a push away if they're unpopular. In 92, both Clinton and Bush really were not terribly popular, even within their own parties, at the times they were nominated. And so that was the push. And then what Perot is able to do was to identify this issue constituency and pull people who cared about that issue constituency into his orbit. So I think you've got both of those things going on. And so, you know, it depends on the strength of the push away from the major parties, but also the strength of the pull to the third party.
Now, what about George Wallace? He ran against a president who came up with a Southern strategy. Was that Southern strategy in response to George Wallace running in 68?
Well, I think it was partially. The Nixon campaign was very worried about Wallace. I think that's true. I think it was also true that the Republican Party was recognized the opportunity that the South offered. After all, Barry Goldwater ran as a staunch conservative and won, I think the only states he carried were in the South other than his home state of Arizona. And so there was, I think, a concern about Wallace in 1968.
How well did he do?
An attempt actually to co-opt his constituency in the middle of the campaign as opposed to waiting, as we saw with Perot, until the next election.
How well did he do, finally?
About 14.5%, I think.
Well, that's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very good, and he was running stronger than that until the end. And the labor movement really put a lot of pressure on its members, and the election was very close. So people felt, gee, Wallace isn't going to win. I better go with one of the major party candidates that I really care about because my vote might determine the outcome of this election.
Isn't that often the case? For example, John Anderson, when he ran in 1980, he started out polling 25%, but he got 7% of the vote in the end. For the same reason, do you think?
Yeah, this wasted vote argument is a strong argument, and the major candidates and major parties make that argument that if you vote for this candidate, it actually amounts to a vote for the opposition. And so the more voters see a clear difference between the major parties, the harder it is for the third party to find a wedge, because people don't want to see their least favored candidate or party win, and so they may settle for, you know, the lesser of two evils as opposed to supporting a third-party candidate that they might favor.
Now, John Anderson was a Republican, so you would assume that he would have taken more votes away from Ronald Reagan than Jimmy Carter. But didn't he hurt Jimmy Carter more?
Yes, yes. I think the people that he attracted tended to be, even though he had been a moderate Republican for his whole career, but he got a lot of support on the left, because a lot of people on the left did not like Jimmy Carter. And Anderson, in a sense, was the beneficiary of push more than pull, I would argue, that it was people who, you know, didn't like Reagan, didn't like Carter, but he really did not have a particular clear constituency. He was, mocked as a Chablis and Brie candidate. And I think that, as it turned out, he actually took more away from Carter than he did from Reagan. But I would say his was an example of push without all that much pull.
You seem to have suggested earlier that you're expecting to see third-party candidates because of dissatisfaction within both of the leading parties. And I'm assuming Ralph Nader is going to run again. I don't know whether Pat Buchanan plans to run again or whether he's decided to stay on TV.
I think we have to be a little careful about predicting when a third-party candidate will emerge, because as Ron said, there is this push factor, but it's important to recognize that it's a push away from both parties that is most compelling. So right now there's a lot of discontent, dissatisfaction with George W. Bush's presidency, and I think by extension with the Republican Party. But that could easily simply benefit the Democratic Party, and depending upon how their nomination process goes and whom they nominate and so on, you know, they may be able to capture most of the discontent that's out there because they would provide an alternative. And that's the traditional sort of strategy of the out party among the between the two major parties. And as long as the out party, in this case the Democrats that don't control the presidency, can capture most of that discontent with Bush, then there really won't be as much room for a major third party. I mean, you always see some third party candidates, but there won't necessarily be a third party candidate that we'll be talking about 10 years from now.
You mentioned a third party theoretical one called Unity 08. The qualification for nomination is that if someone wins the nod, they must put forth a vice presidential candidate from the other party. Do you think that bipartisanship of that sort, which the public often talks about, will really be one of the concerns in this election?
I think you would need more than that. I think you would need a set of issues on which the candidates can agree, which again are distinct from the major parties. I think it's a great challenge to try to put something like this together, but I don't think just a campaign on bipartisanship would have a whole lot of traction. I think it has to be, as Walt says, the sort of pull that you don't like the other parties, but there's something here that you really like. You know, if you end up with a candidate like a Bloomberg or, you know, someone like that, a Hagel, whatever, they may very well be able to create that sort of issue constituency. But I don't think that bipartisanship by itself is a basis for a successful third party.
It's one of those ideas that has a lot of appeal in the abstract, but it is, as Ron says, I think, difficult to convert into, in the heat of a campaign, into a kind of compelling reason to vote for a candidate.
And people were suggesting a Democrat with John McCain in previous elections. Considering where John McCain is right now, that seems kind of odd. On the other hand, some of the people you're talking about as third party candidates are what used to be called liberal Republicans. So maybe that's where the third party will emerge, in the same way that in England, the Liberal Party has kind of captured the more conservative part of the labor vote and the liberal part of the conservative vote.
That's right. And I mean, I think there is the potential constituency in the old sort of, they used to be referred to as silk stocking Republicans from the Northeast and so on, that are, I think there is a real strain within the current Republican coalition that that is, you know, a potential potentially rich ground for a third party candidate of the right sort. But as Ron says, it, you know, whoever the candidate is has to be entrepreneurial and has to be very skillful at making a national appeal, at drawing people in, at giving people a reason to support their candidacy. It's not just a, you know, handsome face. It has to have some real substance to draw a lot of support.
Thank you both so much for being with us today. Walter Stone, professor of political science at the University of California, Davis, where they also make wine, and Ron Rappaport, the John Marshall Professor of Government at the College of William and Mary, co-authors of Three's a Crowd, The Dynamic of Third Parties, Ross Perot, and Republican Resurgence. Thank you both so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.